Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome to our bonus episode of Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara. For this bonus episode, Kim is going to give us a little update on her most recent parole hearing for her offender. If you have not already listened to chapter 2 of the podcast where Kim shares her story, please go back and listen to that so you can have just a little more context about what happened, what led us here. But this is not the first time that you've gone through this parole process, and it will not be the last time. So I am glad that you're willing to kind of process this with me, with our listeners, because there are a lot of people who are going to be going through the same thing. Now, we know that approximately 2% or less, depending on what statistics you look at, of offenders end up serving jail time. So if you look at the number of victims that exist and the number of offenders that exist, there will not be a massive amount of people who are familiar with this process. But for those who have gone through this process, I imagine it must feel very lonely because there are not a lot of people for that exact reason. You know, there's not a lot of people who can understand. So go ahead and tell us kind of what happened leading up to the process, all of that.
Yeah. One of the people that did understand, thankfully, was Avrimi, and he's been on the podcast before. You've heard his story about this, but I was able to speak with him that day as well. And for as few people as there are who go through it, I want to preface this by saying that I am probably the best case scenario. Leading up to this parole hearing, you start getting emails, and they're just automated emails from the Department of Corrections saying that the offender where you are listed as a victim on the case is going to be eligible for parole in 6 months, and then in 3 months, and then in this month, and this month. And they're just the automated ones. If you'd like more information, you can call Victim Services with the DOC. The first one of those that I got was in 2018. I was not expecting it. It wasn't a phone call. It was out of the blue. And he was sentenced to 24 years to life, which we talk about all the time. The truth in sentencing is that there is none. He was just over halfway through that minimum sentence. And that's indeterminate in Colorado, meaning he could be imprisoned up to his entire lifetime. So for us to have to start going to parole that early was concerning. We also had to sit through community corrections, which is completely different from the parole process, meaning that he could be released to a halfway house to further his treatment and reintegrate with society. Now, thankfully, when you have sexual predators like this, they typically don't do that, but it doesn't mean that they can't. The community corrections boards that he had applied to that first round had just outright denied him, but that is something that he can reapply for every 6 months, I believe. For parole, the first time that we went was in January of 2020, and we were in person. It was a cluster, to say the least. We were put into a room with a bunch of other victims with very little information, basically told to write a victim impact statement. And about 5 minutes before it was our turn to go, they asked us, are you wanting to speak on camera or off? Do you want him to know that you're here or no? These are questions that I would have liked a little time to have thought about. It wasn't just me. It was also both of my other roommates from college at that time, our parents, and Mike. That was the first one that we went through. And when I heard him talking and he appeared on the screen, I had expected a pretty visceral reaction, and it wasn't. I was just dumbstruck because this person is exactly the same, maybe a little more gray hair, but he sounded and spoke exactly the same as he did that morning in my apartment. The next one we did was during COVID. It was simply a call-in, and I basically did the same thing where I submitted my victim impact statement and reiterated that for the parole board member who was hearing what was going on. To this point, he had not started any kind of sex offender treatment in the Department of Corrections. That changed, though, this year. We got a notification, again via email, that he was being moved to the Denver intake facility where he would be assessed for treatment and begin that sex offender rehabilitation treatment. When that happens, it triggers a different type of parole hearing to take place. So he waived his right to a parole hearing in January. They kicked it over to July, which brings us to this one that we were just in. This one lasted far longer than the others had previously, and there were far more questions about what he was learning, and I was not adequately prepared for this one. I'll admit I kind of had my head in the sand and was pretty pissy that we had to go do this anyway, because he's not made reasonable progress in treatment. He's not any better. He's clearly not rehabilitated. Just because he started and he's able to go to parole, we all have to show up. And it's not, oh, here's your call-in time. It'll be 15 minutes and you're done. It's a window from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. You could get a call at any point during that time and it'll be the parole board and then they'll put you on. So I was ridiculously nervous for this one. And I don't really know why this one more so than the others. It doesn't have to make sense. Kara said it. I'm kind of processing in real time as I'm talking to you here too. And Kara is going to live react to what I have to say. But I have now taken a week to think through this and gather my thoughts and frankly dissociate for a while because I ran away to the cabin in the woods and it was lovely. But as I was getting all of my stuff ready, I just felt this overwhelming nervousness, and so much so that I ended up just throwing up so much right beforehand. I was so nervous. I went down to Mike's office so that I could be there with him while this took place. They're going to call first, so we would be able to hear Piros on his call talking to the board member, and then we would be able to do our statements with the board member afterwards, and that's out of his presence. So he doesn't know that we're listening. He knows that there's a possibility, but he doesn't know like who's on the call, who's listening, or what we say afterwards. For that, I am happy. It is not something I want to have to stand up in front of him and say again like we did in sentencing, although that can happen in front of a full board review. This one is just one board member. And so she gets on, he's brought in from DOC, and he's about to start. Let me back up. After I puke my guts up, I sit down in Mike's office, and he's got his setup so that I can be on video on the bigger screen and we don't have to share a phone. And we went and snagged Rob. Now, Rob is the other prosecutor who was prosecuting the case. He's also now the assistant district attorney and a good friend of ours. We asked him, hey, do you want to come in and listen to this? He's like, yeah, I've never heard one. Hello, everyone. Put a pin in that. Never heard one. When Mike went to parole with me the first time, he'd never been there. Just let that sink in. So he comes in and it's three of us in Mike's office. And we listen through the next 40 minutes to the man who broke into my apartment after stalking me for a week, held me there and sexually assaulted me, weaponized therapeutic language, and basically take zero real accountability for what he had done. He's now been in treatment for what amounts to about 4 months. He's clearly learned the buzzwords and little else. And the part that I will be very honest with that has just stuck in my brain that is bothering the shit out of me is that he was asked, well, what happened? What happened that morning or during the commission of the crime? And he says, well, I'm pretty sure it was nighttime and I had seen her and I thought she was attractive, so I followed her. And then I broke in and we had sex. I had sex with her. Friends, if you're just joining us, I would hope that you would understand how very, very wrong that is. Sexual assault and sex are completely different things. Just because they share three letters in common does not make them equitable in any way, shape, or form. So for him to be telling a parole board member that we had sex was just awful. He blamed a million other things besides himself. He lied outright about many aspects, not just of this crime, but about his circumstances. And he can do that. He can say whatever he wants. He didn't have a parole plan. He was hoping for an interstate compact where he would be able to go back to Salt Lake City in Utah. His mom spoke on his behalf. And beyond that, there was no real substance. It was re-victimizing, to say the least. I had very eloquent things in my head that I would say, and I've written victim impact statements before, and I've spoken on this, and for the love of God, I am paid to speak words. And I was so flabbergasted at the end that I don't even know what came out of my mouth. I straight up had one of those moments from Old School where you black out, very Will Ferrell-esque.
Yes.
Yeah. I have no idea what I said. And thankfully, I didn't record his part. I am going to request a transcript, but I am allowed to record my own piece of this. It is something that is on record. So I did that. And Kara, with your permission and my consent, I'd like to play that for you now.
Let's go.
And I have not listened back to this yet. I'm going to be about surprised as you all are. Enjoy. There we go. Hi there. My name's Kim. I am the sexual assault victim in this case. If it's okay, I will go ahead and start off. I know we have time constraints, but we certainly have a lot of thoughts after listening to that. Where do you stand on having listened to a bunch of these and seeing or hearing what he had to say? Because I'm confused as to knowing that he's going to be deferred, given that he's only hit some of the criteria.
Yeah, right. No, so I've not made a decision as of yet. For sure, I want, you know, your all statement weighs heavily in my decision. So I'm not really at a decision at this moment. You're absolutely right. He is in treatment and has not, you know, it's new. Treatment is new at this point in time. So, yeah, but again, I'm not at a decision for sure.
Okay. I mean, there's a lot of things that I could go into. I think the most important, though, is that this entire process still is incredibly re-victimizing. This has been something that happened over a decade ago. We're going on 17 years, and we still all have to deal with his lack of accountability, the fact that he gets to come up and have all of this time to practice what he's going to say, to weaponize therapeutic language, to state all of these things that are categorically untrue. And the fact that he cannot say my name, say Abby's name, say Haley's name, he takes no accountability for what he did. He absolutely fabricated much of what he was just saying to you all of these years later and still wants to be released to this community tells me that he is not only a threat, he will absolutely reoffend. The fact that he is saying I had sex with her, that should have been day one that he learned that that is not sex. That is sexual assault, and there is no way that there is anything that should cross over in his mind still. I am just flabbergasted at him getting on here and saying the things that he did. And I understand that that is your job to listen to what offenders in treatment have stated. But I can tell you, if he had a TBI during that time, there was no indication of that. I had to spend 2 hours with this man covering my face on top of me, raping me. There is nothing about what he said or what he did that tells me that he wasn't absolutely in his frame of mind and that this was premeditated. He knew all kinds of things about all of us and our safety, our mental health, and our entire core being has been devastated by this man's actions. This was not the first time. He lied about that. I have had other victims of his reach out to me when they were minors and say that this was something that was not only a pattern of behavior, but he did with intent. He is going to sit here and lie and practice his speech and try to get everything that he can on record until he is paroled to his mom in some other state or in this community. And I promise you, wherever that will be, it will be a travesty. He will absolutely reoffend. And there is nothing that I just heard on that call that doesn't sit in my mind the same way that it did on the morning, not night, morning of May 12th in 2006.
I mean, go ahead.
Oh,
is there more?
That's a little more. Yeah. Pause it here. But that was a little more forceful than I usually speak.
No, I mean, it's like this goes back to what we always say about why we're here. And it's like, because you are able to stand up and do that. Like, it's not easy. You are passionate and you are impacted by this. And you can hear it in your voice that it impacted you and that you're passionate about it. And it's like, this is why we do it, because we can. Like, we can share these stories so that other people who can't speak for themselves, who can't stand up and do that, can hear it. And they can glean some confidence that they can do it, or they can just learn about the process. Like, that is why we're here. I think you sounded powerful. Like, I think it's what we need. Like, too many people get off too easily And I'm glad that you stated the way you felt. Like, you have opinions and you stated them. Like, that, I'm like, yeah, state those opinions. Like, let's go.
I don't understand how I just said it like that, though, and didn't cry. Because usually when I am that worked up, like, it's automatically attached to my tear ducts.
Yeah, right? I know.
I don't know. So from here, the board member then offers other testimony. My best friend and roommate at the time went into hers. She had written some of hers in advance. And so she was able to pull from what she had just heard with what she had written. I just had bullet pointed a couple of notes that I knew I wanted to hit. And again, like I had said, leading into this is that, like, we had sex. That's not sex. It's rape. And then came the coolest part, which was Mike got an opportunity to talk. Again, folks, this rarely, if ever, happens because prosecutors don't know when these offenders are up for parole. We are notified as victims of the case, and prosecutors can opt in, but so often, you know, this isn't part of their world. Why did I just feel like singing Little Mermaid?
Part of his world.
Anyway, but this isn't part of the case life that they see. Once they get to that sentencing, that's it for them. They have to go on to their next part of the docket. So for Mike to be able to then speak up, and he's here in his capacity as a prosecutor, not as my husband, for good reason. And I have his permission to go ahead and play that now. So you'll be able to hear that.
I love hearing Mike in his, like, professional capacity too. Like, because
I know,
that's not
so
how
different.
I met him. So I, like,
right.
I love these moments.
I'm going to skip past my roommate's part here. She does point out that he stole her underwear. Again, if you heard my story, you know that he was found with many pairs of women's underwear, one of which being my roommate's. And she's talking about the victimization that she and my other roommate felt because their home was invaded, their sense of safety. They are just as much victims as I am, even if they weren't victims of sexual assault. So she did a really great job of articulating that.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Nicola. My name is Michael Rourke. I'm the elected district attorney here in Weld County. I was the one of two attorneys who tried this case back in 2007. Seated over to my right is Rob Miller. He's my assistant district attorney. Rob was my trial partner back in 2007. We started working on this case within a couple of weeks after the assault of Kim and the break-in of their apartment. And I want to focus my comments, if I may, on a couple of different aspects. Number one, I understand why Kim is particularly fired up, to say the least. What she didn't comment on is the long-term impact on her. And I want to make sure that you understand that. Following this assault, she was diagnosed with PTSD. And as a result, or as a component of that PTSD, suffers from psychogenic non-epileptic seizures. She still has those to this day. When she goes into those seizures, that has been described to me as her body is reliving the traumatic incident that she was put through. When she goes into these seizures, the first thing that her hands do is go to her neck. She's trying to remove the shirt that he placed over her face when he sexually assaulted her for 2 hours. The sexual assault happened between 5:30 and about 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning, as opposed to what Mr. Piro said. And by the way, it's pronounced Piros. Today was the first day we ever heard that there was any kind of a Hispanic connotation to his last name.
Oh, yeah. I should point that out. He asked that his name be pronounced in a Hispanic dialect because the board member herself was also Hispanic.
Kim has repeatedly had seizures, has gone through counseling and treatment for 18 years now, almost 18 years, 17 years. And so the impact on her specifically, and I am certainly not minimizing the impact on Abby and Haley, who we still keep in contact with today as well. But I want to focus that comment on Kim's long-term impact on her. She will live with this until the day she dies. There's no doubt about that in my mind. Really, the other commentary that I want to offer to you is from the public safety standpoint, because I have a lot of red flags that went up as I listened to him speak to you this morning about his safety to return to the community. Number one, I'm very well aware of the standard that you have to consider in terms of whether or not he has successfully progressed through treatment in order to be considered for parole. Abby and Kim did a great job of highlighting some of the concerns about just his basic terminology and whether or not he understands what he did, why he did it, what the impact was on them, what the impact was on her. And the fact that he can't verbalize the victim's name is very telling to me. But there are a couple of other things, and Abby highlighted a piece of this, but there was some genuine dishonesty in his commentary to you. And I can tell you from Rob and my review of his all the police reports through this investigation, because I got to tell you, this was a massive investigation done by the Greeley Police Department, because we were trying to figure out how he wound up in their apartment. We did not believe that he had, quote unquote, lucked his way in. And I say that with the utmost respect to Abby, to Haley, and to Kim. We never could figure out what the answer was. He, in the afternoon hours of May 12, 2006, after he had sexually assaulted Kim, after he had broken into Abby and Haley's apartment and taken personal property from them, he was trespassed from another apartment complex about three blocks away. He was found hiding in the gymnasium area, the workout area, taking the photographs that Abby has described, trying to select his next victim. At the time he was trespassed, he was given a written documentation from management and told not to return. That was hours after this assault, when he had these mommy issues that he's described to you. 3 weeks to the day later, he was found in that same apartment complex, in that same location, taking photographs of other women, laying at the sunbathing at the pool, walking up and down the stairs. We have all those pictures and evidence. There's no doubt what he was doing. At the time that the Greeley Police Department arrested him, he had a duffel bag, a backpack full of women's underwear. Not just Abby's, full of women's underwear. Dozens and dozens of pairs. One of those, Abby was able to identify as having belonged to her and identified at a trial. So that, I hope, goes into your consideration of whether or not this had ever happened before. I don't buy for a minute the fact that he had not been in other women's apartments, homes, taking these items of personal property. Today is the first day we have ever heard that he had anger issues towards his mother, and I'll come back to her in a moment. This is the first day we've ever heard that he had ruined a relationship with an 8-year-long girlfriend relationship. This is the first time we've ever heard that he had stress from school, which motivated him to commit this crime. What he neglected to tell you was that at the time that this assault happened, he was a criminal justice major at Ames Community College and was a 4.0 student. He was learning how we investigate these crimes so that he could avoid apprehension. I am absolutely convinced of that. He tried during the course of the pretrial litigation to raise this same DUI, traumatic brain injury. His defense attorney had him evaluated at the state hospital for competency, and it was very clear from the doctors at the state hospital that he was not incompetent to proceed, that he was not suffering from a traumatic brain injury. The anger issues that he expressed towards his mother was stunning to me, because found in his personal property at the time that search warrants were executed at his mother's house and his stepfather's house, they were living apart, were pictures of his mother standing underneath a banner that said happy birthday, and she was topless. This is the same woman that came to every pretrial hearing and every day of trial trying to figure out who Kim was, trying to identify Kim so that she could engage in what I will best describe as retaliatory or threatening conduct, trying to keep her from the courtroom. This is a family, and particularly this individual, this DOC inmate, represents a massive risk to whatever community he walks into. And today was simply yet another indication, another highlight of the fact that he will be a threat to every woman in whatever community he moves to. The fact that he has no firm plan is stunning to me. I have served on community corrections boards. I have served on boards that have considered transitional placement out of the Department of Corrections. I have served on the Colorado Crime and Criminal Justice CCJJ Task Force. I have been on the Sentence Progression Working Group. I have never heard of somebody showing up to a parole hearing saying, I don't really have a firm plan, but I'd like to get out anyway, and I'll figure it out when I get out. And maybe I'll transfer through the interstate compact. Maybe I'll just stay in Denver. To me, that is an enormous red flag that it represents a significant risk to this community. I don't know if Rob has any commentary after I've gone on my spiel, but Ms. Alcala, first of all, I want to thank you very much for your time. I hope you hear the passion in my voice, in Kim's voice, in Abby's voice, because this is one we feel very, very strongly about. I have a 9-year-old daughter. I cannot imagine him being released into the community at this point in time. Only, what, five months into treatment after being sentenced to the maximum by Judge Hartman here in Weld County. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but I want to thank you very much for your time.
He basically gave a closing argument.
I mean, right, but also how powerful would it be for these hearings if the attorney who prosecuted the case could step in and give that information? Like you only have a piece of paper.
Him or investigators? Like,
right.
Really, right. Anyone, because that parole board member didn't have that information.
Exactly. All they have is like a file.
Yeah. And it doesn't even include usually the PSI, the pre-sentencing investigation, all of the things that he had admitted to, or maybe he double backed on, or whatever it might have been. It was baffling. And if there were someone there to be like, actually, this is bullshit, here's why. But can you imagine the strain on resources in a profession that most people don't want to already be in anyway?
Right.
So for him to be there was so helpful. So at this point, we concluded being able to give our statements. We were supposed to keep it under 20 minutes total for everyone. And then the board member addresses us.
Absolutely. Thank you all. You all did a very good job today. I heard you loud and clear. So thank you for being here. Without you all here, you know, I don't have this perspective. So I think it's important that you're here. And I want to thank you for being here, listening to it, doing the hard stuff. You know, that's hard to do. So thanks again. I will turn you back over to Tara. And I will conclude this for now. So thank you so much. And you should know my decision probably within the next 24 hours. It'll be available. So thank you so much.
Yeah. So how long did it take for her to get the decision back?
We had it within an hour that he was denied.
Yeah, I would assume. I mean,
and she was great. Like, I think that's the part that sucks. Like, our victim witness coordinator, she was great with the information she had. The parole board member, great with the information that she had.
Right.
Now, I want your feedback, but here's the biggest part. I stopped recording there, obviously. And Rob looks at us and is just like, is that what it's like every time?
Right.
Like, pretty much.
Right.
Mike walks out of the room. Goes and gets victim witness coordinator for his office, comes back in, and he's like, Kimberly, we're about to make office policy. And right there, because of course he did, right there decided with his victim witness coordinator, who's wonderful and been doing this a long time. He said, you know what? Here's a gap in the system. Prosecutors need to know when this is happening, and we need to have that availability for victims who aren't Kim, who can't just pick up a call or ask their husband or friends or people that they still keep in contact with what to do or what to say or to be looped in on these things. And so they decided to set up an email address where they can sign up for Vine, which is the victim notification network that DOC uses. And that way, we will know when these offenders like this are going to be up for parole, and our office can be another touch point for those victims. And for as much as I was shutting down at that point and just totally dissociating, because that's my move, I was immensely proud of him doing that right in that moment, because he and Rob sitting there both recognized that need and that gap that needed to be filled.
Yeah. And I think I would assume across the board, that is a gap in systems across the country. And you and Mike, and this case specifically, are in a unique position where, yes, Mike is a very passionate attorney about what he does, but he obviously has a vested interest, right? Sure. Like, he has a vested interest in this case at this point. And so it kind of drives him even more to say, we're going to change the policy. How many jurisdictions are there that need to fill that gap and they don't have a vested interest? And they're like, we are just like up to our eyeballs in work. I would assume that a vast majority of the prosecuting attorneys in the United States have more cases than they can even keep up with. And so it's like, yeah, this may sound like a great idea to them, but they're like, in actuality, how the hell can we make this happen? So it's very frustrating, because you know that
like you said, these people that are on these boards, all they have is a piece of paper. Maybe they have a file just saying the bare minimum of the case, and all they're going to get. I mean, think if you had a job that you couldn't take time off from and you couldn't sit around all day waiting and you couldn't be there to speak, and the prosecuting attorney wasn't there to speak, and all she had to go on was this little piece of paper and what he said, could be a very different outcome.
And that really is the reality of what typically happens. You know, it's taken me a little bit to be able to get through this and think about what I wanted to say. But even sitting there as I was going through that process, as I'm thinking and listening to his voice and the voices of my friends, I am the best case scenario. And it is still this hard for me. And that needs to change.
Yeah.
It's not okay.
Yeah. I come back over and over and over to these statistics that we know are true about the likelihood of a sexual assault case ending in the offender serving jail time and then, you know, therefore going forth into this parole process. And it's just like, it's so heavy. And that's not why we want to bring this to you guys. We want to always be as authentic as possible and open about what we are going through and share that so that anyone who's listening doesn't feel alone. You know, you hear us say that week after week after week, and we come back to it. And Kim was kind of hesitant to share her recording. She's like, I wasn't as eloquent as I wanted to be. And I was like, I think that's important. I think that's an important part of sharing this. Like, if you're comfortable, I think that, you know, you guys may hear us, or you may see us on social media, or you may see us at a keynote or on TV or whatever, and you may think that we are always put together. I hope you don't think that, but you may think that we still can stand up and make these eloquent, well-spoken speeches. But I think it's important for you to hear that we still are impacted, and for you to know that whatever your response is to these types of situations, that's normal as well. And I just think these are always important conversations to have, and they're not easy, and they're not always happy. They don't always have happy endings. There's any number of people whose stories have been shared that you may have heard here or somewhere else that don't have happy endings, and it's all important.
Yep. We want you to hear the good ones because we want you to have hope, but it's also important that you hear the bad ones too. And you know what? Last week, it felt shitty. It did. And I didn't process it the way that I had hoped that I would. I was pretty tired and just kind of recluse afterwards. And I recognize that in myself. And I still have a lot of problems giving myself enough grace and space to do what I need to do. But it is ongoing. I'm not sharing to garner sympathy or pity or anything like that. I'm sharing because it's real. And whatever you're going through is just as real and just as important. I was talking to my friend Anna, that you guys know from the podcast here, last night, and she had the most, she said the most wonderful thing to me, because I'm talking about, I'm best case scenario, what happens to the people who English is a second language, or they aren't plugged in, or they're so far removed from having to do this and they want to appear, but they don't know what to say or what. And she said, our privilege does not detract from our experiences. And it was so profound to me, because I can have that space in my heart to feel for all of the people who aren't as privileged as me and still be able to validate what I'm feeling as well. And this was one of those moments. So thank you for hanging in there with us. I wanted to provide that update. I don't have some neat little bow to tie on this other than he was denied. It's put out for another 2 years. So we will get right back at it and do this same song and dance over again in 2 years. And I will be full of just as much piss and vinegar by then.
Yeah. And one thing that we talked about on the Patreon live that we had immediately following this, basically, we talked about how it'll be every 2 years, and then it'll be every year, and then it'll be every 6 months. And it just keeps going. And I just come back to how these kind of things are kind of a life sentence for us, and it's not fair. And so if you're listening, or you're going through something and you're like, it's not fair. No, it's not. It's not fair. It sucks. And we want to make sure that we acknowledge that and we highlight that, as well as these beautiful survivor stories that we tell, they are not mutually exclusive. You know, we can have these wonderful best case scenarios, but then we can also have really shitty stuff happening. And so we just want to make sure that we acknowledge the duality of what it means to be a survivor and how all of these things can exist at the same time. And it sucks, but at least we're not in it alone.
Yep. So however you are using your voice today, whether it's speaking up at a parole hearing or a podcast or telling a friend what happened, or even just listening and thinking about your own experience, you are very valid and braver than you will ever know.
Yes.
We will see you next week. Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.